Hello and welcome to the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. I'm Richard Moore and I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
Daniel Freib.
Hi, Richard.
A special guest this week, David Walsh.
Hi, Richard.
So, David, thank you very much for joining us this week. We want to talk to you about a couple of things. You've got a recently published book, Inside Team Sky, so we'll talk a little bit about that. Then maybe we'll talk about Lance Armstrong later on. So the book's been out now a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Can you just describe how that came about? Because it's a very illuminating account of your year sort of living inside Team Sky. And it followed an invitation, I think, from Dave Brailsford at the end of last year, just after the Armstrong scandal kind of came to a head, I suppose. Can you describe, you know, how that contact was made and what your first reaction to it was?
Armstrong had just kind of fallen. It was soon after the October 22nd UCI kind of press conference where Pat McQuaid had said, you know, Lance Armstrong deserves to be forgotten, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, no, I'm actually ready to get back into some cycling journalism because I'd really avoided it. I mean, I didn't want to go to the Tour de France in the final week. Sunday Times wanted me to go and do a piece on Bradley Wiggins, and I didn't really want to go because I felt kind of cut off from it. Anyway, once Armstrong was outed, I felt I had a way back in. Because, well, if you take him out, the guys who are doing well now are not going to be compared to Armstrong, and that's a much healthier situation. So I'd never interviewed Dave Brailsford. I'd never spoken to Dave Brailsford. I'd watched, you know, I'd been in Beijing when the track team were brilliant, and I'd obviously 2012 had gone really well. I covered the road race in 2012, and I decided now is the time to actually go and interview him. I got onto Fran Miller. It was set up. He told me subsequently that he was really reticent about doing it. He felt he was going to be kind of savaged by a hostile journalist. And when I met him, I found him charming. And his thing was, you know, with relation to Armstrong, what intrigued him was that I had been so unpopular through that period, and I didn't have a problem with being so unpopular. And he couldn't believe that. And I said, well, you'd better believe it, because it really wasn't an issue for me, being the fact that people saw me as a bit of a pariah at that time. We then got on to talking about Team Sky, and he said, do you think we're clean? And I said, well, my gut feeling is you may be clean, but if you put a gun to my head, I'd say you're clean, and then if I heard the click of an empty chamber, I'd be so relieved, because I'm not sure. And he said, how can you not be sure? Because we are clean. And I said, well, if you're clean, why do you get so defensive when you're asked about doping? And he said, we don't get defensive, and we argued. I said, you do. We don't. We do. You don't. That kind of a nonsense. And he said then, just out of the blue, why don't you come with us next season? Live inside the team anytime you like, as often as you like. If you want to spend every week of the season inside the team to watch what we're doing, you're welcome. And I said, yeah, I said, that's an interesting offer. I think I'd consider that. And then he said, the only condition that I would place on you is that you don't just use it as a way of covering the Tour de France. In other words, you come for maybe 2 or 3 days before the Tour, then you turn up at the Tour when nobody within the team will know you, and it'll be difficult. He said, if you were to come to Mallorca in January, if you were to come to Tenerife in March, come at other times, come to the Giro d'Italia, by the time then you turn up at the Tour, you're a face that we're familiar with.
They're comfortable with you.
Comfortable
with your presence.
And I just got excited. I just thought, as a journalist, how could you say no to that? And one of the interesting things about this experiment, I suppose you could call it, is that every time I wrote about it, and the piece would appear on the Sunday Times website as well as in the newspaper, the number of readers on the website, because you can now count them, you can see what everybody reads on a website, pieces about Team Sky trumped every piece by sometimes 3 times.
I mean, really?
Yeah, they were easily the most read pieces. It was 1 week. I think Alex Butler told me 1 week that it was the most read piece in the entire newspaper. So it had a huge following, and it made the Sunday Times, obviously, very supportive of me being with Team Sky. So it was something I went into, I think, with my eyes open, and I enjoyed it.
The interesting parts of your book, I think, is your emphasis on getting to know the people, and not just going there armed with hard questions, in inverted commas, but getting to know people, getting a gut feeling for people, getting to really understand them. And you explain that this is a part of journalism that is actually quite often underestimated, or the importance of it is underemphasized.
Yeah, totally. I mean, my feeling was that Sky were going to be the sum of the individuals. Who are these individuals? Where have they come from? What kind of values do they have? what kind of people are they? Are they the kind of people you would trust? Are they the kind of people you get to like? What are their backgrounds? And I'm not, here I'm talking about what I would regard as the key people. People like Brailsford, like Rod Ellingworth, like Tim Kerrison, like Alan Farrell, like the head carer Mario Pafundi, like Gary Blim, the head mechanic. They were the people that, they're the people for me who make Skye what it is. It's not Dave Brailsford, he's just one person. He likens himself to the conductor of the orchestra. Well, it's not really a great analogy in my eyes. My feeling would be that it's like maybe he's the general, but he's got five lieutenants, and the lieutenants are actually key because they make the team what it is. And I did spend a lot of time getting to know those guys, because when I think about it, I think one of the first people I got to know in US Postal Team was Dr. Prentice Stephen, who had been with the team when they started out, and then he got kicked out basically in 1997 by Mark Gorski. Prentice Stephen told me his story, and I thought, this team decided to dope before Lance Armstrong came along. Prentice Stephen would not have been kicked out. He's an American doctor replaced by a Spanish doctor. And Gorski, when Prentice Stephen complains on the basis, I think you got rid of me because I'm not a doper and you're replacing me with a doper, Gorski said, repeat that in public, we'd sue your ass. So you immediately think, you know what? If those guys were clean, Gorski and that team, they wouldn't have done that to Prentice Stephen. Prentice Stephen's a good guy. We now see he's working with Team Garmin Sharp. And what we're talking about here is a guy that people believe in. Now, before I ever had any doubts about Lance Armstrong, I had doubts about US Postal. Why isn't there a Prentice Stephen in relation to Team Skye? Who's the doc who left and said, I'll tell you why they got rid of me? They got rid of me because I wasn't a doc.
David, I mean, you mentioned how popular those Sunday Times pieces were, but and obviously your stock was very high after Armstrong was finally brought down. But very quickly, the reaction to your coverage of Team Skye was divided, and you include in the book some of the tweets that you received, fairly hostile, fairly critical, and almost suspicious of you, and whether you were you'd been sucked into the Murdoch machine, the Sunday Times being owned by, obviously, Rupert Murdoch and Team Skye as well. How prepared were you for that? Did that take you by surprise, and how difficult was that to sort of deal with?
Yeah, the vindictiveness of it took me a little bit by surprise. I wouldn't say it knocked me back, but it definitely shook me a little bit. I wasn't on Twitter for years and years and years. I only went on in October 2011. And the thing that I've discovered about Twitter is that the people who don't use their own name are the most vindictive. That tells you something about human nature. It's like the guy on the road on Octoways who was screaming doper, doper at the Skye car. And Rod Ellingworth was in the car and he stopped the car and he said to the guy, Rod got out, pulled in and said, what do you mean we're dopers? Where are you from? And the guy said, I'm Danish. And Rod said, well, you know, do you really believe we're dopers? And the guy said, no, I don't really, but I'm just shouting. You know, I'm just part of the mob here, and this is what the mob is doing. And I just feel that, you know, the way you talk to, I've never engaged with people who are abusive on Twitter. And I kind of think maybe I should, but I mean, I interviewed Nigel Owens, who's the referee who you could say who's come out as gay, and he gets a lot of abuse on Twitter. And I said to him, do you immediately block people who cross that line into really nasty personal abuse? And Nigel said, I do block them, but not before I retaliate. And he said, I say something to them that they're not going to like, then I block them. Now, I just haven't got into retaliation with these people because I don't believe I want to have any involvement with them. To me, you know, all of these people, if you were to actually confront them and you were to sit down and talk to them, you'd find that they weren't nearly as aggressive when they had to be themselves, as opposed to hiding behind a pseudonym.
David, it's such an emotionally charged issue, doping, and whether you're trying to prove someone is doped or whether you're trying to prove someone, or you end up suggesting that someone is not doped. Was there not part of you, before you took on this assignment, which just wanted to get away from this whole issue and distance yourself from this whole issue and concentrate on another story?
No, I didn't. I just thought, if Alex Ferguson at the time or David Moyes now said, look, come and spend 10 weeks of a season living inside Man United, I'd say, yes, brilliant, love to do it. If George Lancaster said, come with the England rugby team and live with us when we're training or playing the Six Nations, I'd jump. Now, Dave Brailsford says it about a team that's favourite to win the Tour de France. Of course I'm going to jump again and say, yes, I'd love to do it. And my feeling was that they were clean, because I looked at Brailsford and I thought, do I believe that Chris Hoy, Victoria Pendleton, all the people who were the pillars of that track cycling team, do I believe they were clean? Yes, I do. So now we know that Brailsford has run what I believe is a clean track cycling program. Why would he suddenly come along after 18 years of success with the track team and say, no, I'm going to change my ethics completely because this is a different sport and I'm going to become a doper, master doper, and I'm going to organise the most sophisticated doping program known to sport, better than US Post. Did I really think he would do that? No, I didn't. So my gut feeling was that there's a good chance this is clean. So I thought that would be just such a good story to tell, to say to people, you know what, you can trust these guys. No, I didn't go in there. That was my feeling. But I didn't go in there adamant that that was going to be the result. Because what happens if I went in there and thought, you know what, I think there's a rider culture separate to the team management that are doping. Would I have reported that? I would have loved to have reported that. That would have been a sensational story. The guy inside Team Sky shows that they're actually dopers. And in a way, you know, we can talk about it again, but the Jonathan Tiernan Locke story was a difficult one to write, because you could argue that at that point in the process it didn't deserve to be made public. But I felt they were the UCI's protocols and I couldn't really be adhering to them. This was a Team Sky rider who had a doping question to answer. And I just felt, well, they bring me inside the team. Because of the access I've got, I end up knowing people who know people, getting that story. Of course I was going to reproduce it.
And you were aware when you broke that story of the charge that you were sort of trying to re-establish your credentials as an objective journalist.
Yeah. I like the verb re-establish. I wasn't aware that I had lost them, but if you say so. The key of that Jonathan Tiernan Locke story is that Dave Brailsford, for all his brilliance, didn't do his job well enough in relation to Jonathan Tiernan Locke. I'm not saying Jonathan Tiernan Locke doped. I don't know that. My feeling is he's got a difficult situation in front of him. It's, as far as I know, it's not behind him yet. But there were good reasons for Dave Brailsford looking very closely at Jonathan Tiernan Locke. And I don't think he did look very closely. I mean, when I spoke to Dave and asked him about the L'Equipe article, that's basically after the Tour of Mediterranean, I think, where the journalist writing had said most of the riders in this race don't believe Jonathan Tiernan Locke is clean. And when I asked Dave about that, I had a sense that he didn't know that that had been written. He didn't say he hadn't read it, but that was my sense.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
David, you said there that your gut instinct was perhaps that Team Sky was clean, but around the time that the reasoned decision came out, you did a number of radio interviews, one of which I heard was on TalkSport with Andy Gray and Richard Keys, in which you did kind of finish up by saying that questions needed to be asked of Bradley Wiggins as a British Tour de France champion, and that you felt those questions hadn't been asked by people who were covering the Tour in 2012. And I just wonder, at what point did your gut feeling adjust from?
Yeah, the questions that I felt needed to be asked, it needed to be established how much contact Bradley had with Gert Leinders, and I didn't know that at the time, and I never read an article that said to me Bradley had virtually no contact with Leinders. Bradley has always worked with Richard Freeman, and Richard Freeman is basically his doc, his personal doc. He's the one that he's spent most time with, blah, blah. You know the way the Sky Riders are all divided up amongst the medical people? Well, Richard Freeman was looking after Bradley at that time. That was what I was alluding to. At what point did I believe that Sky were clean? If I had to put a moment on it where a kind of a feeling that they were clean, but you know, when Dave Brailsford asked me, I said, I think you're clean, but I have some doubts. Because of the way you respond to the whole doping thing, how successful you've been, the fact that you had Gert Leinders in the team when we know he was involved in doping in Rabobank. So my gut feeling is that Bradley Wiggins won the Tour de France clean. But if the gun was at my head, I'd be really relieved not to have died. I just think, wow, glad, almost like I got away with that. And then I remember at one point in the Giro, I went for a long coffee and chat with Richard Freeman, and Richard did an interview on the record. And then when we were walking back, I think he said to me, you know, he said, when Chris Froome did that brilliant performance at the Vuelta in 2011, I wasn't sure that that was right. He said he'd made a lot of improvement. So he said, it was almost at a point, he said, where I couldn't congratulate him because I had doubts. And he said, I went and I looked at his biological passport and I got all his stuff from Barlow World and I looked back and I did every investigation that I could do in relation to his blood values. Had anything happened, his blood values from previously to that Vuelta? And he said, they absolutely hadn't changed. Nothing had changed. And he said, I said to Dave Brailsford, you can come up with whatever reasons you can for Chris's great performance, you know, last week. But he said, it's not down to his blood being changed or altered in any way. That has not happened. And I thought, that's exactly the kind of team that a clean team should be. That the doc should have doubts if somebody suddenly approves. He should want to investigate it. Because the doping culture in cycling has survived on the basis of people looking the other way always. And I thought, here is a doc telling me about his personal doubt about a performance and investigating it and coming to the conclusion that it actually was not explained by doping. I thought that was pretty convincing evidence.
At the risk of declare myself interested here, but the Gert Leinders story was something that was addressed during the 2012 tour. Myself and Owen Slott had a perhaps half hour, 40 minute sit down with Dave Brailsford, in which we had a very frank, very long conversation about the circumstances that led to him reassessing the entire medical structure, him and Dr. Freeman reassessing their entire medical practice. And as you know, as you've spent enough time with Dave Brailsford now, you'll know that conversations veer on and off the record, and you in the sort of job of trying to gather as much information as you possibly can, sometimes there are things that are explained that you can't necessarily go fully into in a written piece. But, you know, during that Tour de France, the Geert Leinders question was rearing itself almost on a daily basis. From a personal perspective, I felt Dave Brailsford dealt with that and kind of did enough to move it beyond being the kind of sticking point that it always returned back to. Don't you feel the kind of like Bradley Wiggins having his kind of victory questioned after the fact was a little bit unfair, considering that you hadn't been there, you hadn't been on the tour, and you said at the start, the outset, getting to know all of these different people, understand their characters and their motivations, commenting from kind of a distance about it, when you had as Richard said, your stock was so high, it was incredibly powerful and influential at that time, and that is a consequence of the coverage for this year.
I think that is something that maybe we don't convey when we're on the ground, when we're at races, we perhaps don't convey forcibly enough that, like David said, you develop a sense from talking to a lot of these people, and often the conversations are off the record, and perhaps, you know, it's our duty as journalists to kind of affirm and reaffirm that we have that gut feeling based on evidence that we're gathering on the ground. But sometimes I think the public perhaps don't trust us.
Maybe this is a symptom also of journalist stock being quite low as a trusted profession.
Yeah.
I think, you know, all of us have been frustrated at different times by this idea that we are not to be trusted, that we are somehow compromised. And that business of getting to know people takes years, takes a long, long time. And sometimes your conclusions or your opinions can be influenced by that. And it can be a hard thing to explain in a written piece. And particularly, I think, in the podcast and talking about it, you can sometimes explain it a little bit better.
And there is this all-consuming climate of suspicion and cynicism in cycling. Now, everything that, whether we say, a rider says, a team manager says, is the subject of suspicion.
All those years of getting to know these people has to be worth something, doesn't it? And it boils down to, in the end, whether you trust a journalist or not.
Yes. And just going back to your question, Lionel, about was that unfair in Bradley, it was where I was coming from. I wasn't at that Tour de France. I was hearing that, you know, Fran Miller was apparently saying to journalists, we don't want you to ask a question about, I don't know, was it a German?
Cofidis, yeah, it was Remy de Gregorio. Yeah. I remember quite specifically that, because that was wrongly reported after the event by a couple of people. It was reported that she had said no questions about doping. In fact, what she said was no questions about Cofidis.
Yeah, well,
Bradley had ridden for Cofidis. She also had a personal interest there because her brother had obviously ridden for Cofidis.
Yeah, well, I felt it was. I heard it as not so much no question about doping, but no question about
the latest doping scandal.
Yeah, the latest doping scandal.
And it was wrong, absolutely.
Yeah, I just thought, well, why would they do that? Bradley's up there. He's now, once you become the yellow jersey, you become the kind of unofficial spokesperson for the peloton. And if anybody needs to answer questions on doping, it's the guy winning clean. And he's in such a brilliant position to answer questions if he's clean. And that's the question. I did ask Bradley when I eventually got around to interviewing him, you know, why were you like that? Why did you respond in that really aggressive way about the social media question? Because, you know, from a distance, that looks really defensive. And so that's the kind of questions I was talking about.
But you know, David, as well as we do, that often a press conference setting where the journalists are sat in rows is often the worst possible time to get any kind of nuanced or any detailed kind of answer out of anybody. So you can almost, they're almost there just for kind of an obligation's sake, really. I mean, we saw that during the tour this year. I'm not sure if you were there in Orange where, you know, Chris Froome got the same question, 15-minute press conference, restricted, probably backfired against Sky because it just meant that everybody's sense of getting the killer question in was heightened, and so it just became 15 minutes of them flat batting the same question, just asked in a different kind of way. The irony about that, the day that Fran said this news about Remy Di Gregorio has just broken, we don't know anything about it, so please no questions about Cofidis. The irony is that was the day that Brailsford did sit down with two journalists to talk about Geert Leinders and try to offer some kind of understanding. And as you said there earlier, the line that convinced you about Dr. Freeman came in the off-the-record chat afterwards as you're walking back from having done the on-the-record interview. And I mean, that is the tightrope we walk all the time, every time we deal with any kind of doping issue. And with the chat about Leinders, we were going into some really worrying areas about medical confidentiality and, you know, all kinds of different things about, you know, GP's practice.
And the Leinders story boiled down, whatever had gone on in the past with Geert Leinders, it did boil down. For me, the important question was he involved in doping at Team Sky? And, you know, we all have, as journalists, go about our jobs in different ways. The Leinders story was broken in about May, after Theo de Roy gave his interview at the end of April 2012. It was out there. It was out in the public domain. It wasn't a story that one of us heard and sat on. Once it was out in the public domain, I made my inquiries with Team Sky. I spoke to Richard Freeman, Brailsford and Fran Miller about him. I was satisfied that whatever he'd done in the past, he wasn't involved in doping at Team Sky. So for me, it wasn't a story. Obviously, it became a huge story at the tour because everything that could be dug up was relevant.
Yeah, but Richard, it was a story because Dave Brailsford had set out a stall. Yeah. We're not going down this
absolutely,
road.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Remember, he never said, we've changed our policy.
No, that's true.
And he really needed to say that. But there was just one point about that I'd like to make about that whole attitude from the whole Sky response to doping questions. I thought they were vastly better in 2013 than they were. Nobody was saying, and at a Chris Froome press conference, we don't want any questions on this aspect of doping or that aspect of doping. Because I think Chris Froome was sitting up there saying, it's going to come, I'm cool.
I think that's true. I'll read you back one bit from your book, because I think this is relevant to this point, where I think part of that in 2012 was a naivety, and you mentioned this several times in the book about Brailsford, there is a naivety there. And you talk about them being jeopardised by the fact that the people they depend on in the team don't come from that doping culture. They don't think like cheats. And yes. I think that was definitely a fact in 2012. They were wiser to it in 2013. Yes.
Also, I think going back to the initial setting up of Team Sky, one of Brailsford's headline statements was that they would not hire anyone with an association with doping. And that was something that they couldn't possibly have adhered to from day one.
And still probably can't.
Possibly not, but...
Hold on. They don't have any doctor now who's been involved in
No, but recycling. Beyond the doctor, I mean, another point you make in the book is that given where cycling has come from and the people that people have worked on different teams as mechanics or soigneurs or whatever, you know, it's quite hard in the realm of professional cycling to find people with no previous history of doping, whether that be just knowing about it and turning a blind eye.
Yes.
And you do make the point that what would be the point in digging into these people's past, who are quite peripheral people on the team?
Yeah, well, they're important people, but they're smaller players.
Yeah.
And the thing about the that whole thing of, I mean, I could have spent my whole year digging into the past of numerous members of Sky's background team, and I could have used it to embarrass Dave Brailsford. And I just thought, what am I doing? What would I be doing if I did that? I'd be showing that the policy Sky have is a flawed policy, and I think it is a flawed policy. I don't agree with their zero tolerance because it's just not enforceable. Unless, you know, I mean, if you're in any industry, you hire people with experience in that industry. That's the way it works in any aspect of life. Now, you cannot hire people in cycling who don't have some kind of a doping past. As you said, is it that they look the other way? Well, people can't survive. You know, doping can't survive unless people look the other way. That's why the Lance Armstrong story became such a monster. So many people kept looking the other way. But if I had gone after Dave Brailsford and the team on the basis of this, what I believed is a flawed zero-tolerance policy, well, I'm hurting a lot of decent individuals and ruining their lives and taking away their jobs in order to,
And I think we can make the point that the policy is flawed. It doesn't mean that they are doping now. And that, yeah, again, that comes back. That's the fundamental point for me. And
of course, one of the interesting things about, you know, some of the people who were on the team in 2012 who are no longer on the team in 2013, just Bobby Julich, Stephen de Jong, for example. Our question is whether they were, from an outsider's point of view, trying to cover the team, the question is whether they were involved in or facilitating doping at Team Sky. My instinct would be that they certainly weren't. And so it comes down to whether you believe people can be redeemed in some way and contribute to a clean and different way of working. And I think that was perhaps where it was slightly unfortunate in the autumn, winter after Bradley Wiggins wins the Tour, that there's this kind of bloodletting of several members of the staff go. And it kind of casts a shadow back and makes the public opinion change so that they think, oh, well, they must have been up to no good in Team Sky. So all of that landscape, and it's a...
Yeah, I don't know, Lionel, if it did change the public view of things. I mean, I think there's a lot of members of the public that say, well, Sky have this policy. I'm going to say something else. This is not in the book. And it's a story I heard. I can't say that I could substantiate it. But... my information is that there was a staff meeting before the first interviews at Sky. And we're talking about a staff meeting that didn't involve Dave Brailsford, but involved the rank and file staff members. What are we going to do about this? And the thing was, let's be honest. Let's tell about it. If we've got issues in our past, let us all tell. Because, you know, that's the right thing to do, to be honest. And they probably, on the basis, they can't sack us all. Or they can't sack a lot of
us. So they thought that by being honest, they would actually sort of safeguard their positions.
Exactly.
Yeah.
First guy goes in, Bobby Julich. Maybe Stephen de Jong was, but Stephen de Jong lied the first time. Well, Stevie de Jong first went in and said, I'd never involved in doping. And then I think Steve Peters said, sorry, even though he said that, I don't think we can believe him. And Steve Peters felt that Stephen de Jong would come back and have a different version and tell the truth. And he did as well. Bobby Julich went in and told the truth. And then it was, Bobby was quickly told the contracts have got to be terminated. Bobby, that's the rule. You signed for this, and it wasn't true.
Interesting. And so they attempted to call bluff a little bit.
And then every member of the staff thought.
Hadn't heard that.
David, just having spent a year with them, looking at it now, they've won the last two Tours de France. This is also the culmination of a very long-term project on British Cycling's part, Team Sky. It's a great success story. It's a fantastic success story. Over the past couple of years, we've certainly detected in conversations with Dave Brailsford, other members of the staff, that there is a certain amount of exasperation because it hasn't been acknowledged as such by perhaps the number of people that it should have been. The kind of recognition has been obscured by all of this suspicion, all of the questions, etc. Do you think there's a danger that either Dave Brailsford or perhaps not Sky as a company, but important members of the organisation will decide that really enough is enough? And
no, I don't. No? I have no inside information on this. But I think Team Sky has been an absolute boom to Be Sky B. I think it's been such a feel-good story in a general sense. They've got to win the Tour de France. I mean, you know, when the Alpe d'Huez stage happened, a lot of the Sky guys, I'm thinking Dave Brailsford, Rod Ellingworth, Alan Farrell, Tim Carrison, they were really down that evening. They just saw a lot of nastiness on the mountain. People were drunk, they were shouting abuse. Like, Sky were winning the Tour, but they weren't being cheered on that mountain. They got a lot of abuse. You know, cars being suddenly interfered with, all that stuff. James Murdoch was in the team car number one with Nico Portal and Gary Blehm, I think. And James Murdoch loved it. Thought it was the most thrilling, kind of one of the most thrilling experiences of his life. Thought this was fantastic. We're out there, we're showing them, and we're not going to be sidetracked. And I think that's kind of to me kind of an indication that I think if you look at what News Corp's kind of marketing budget is, I mean, what they spend on marketing, what they're spending on the team is like a tiny fraction, and they're getting a return on that. Now, don't mistake these guys for kind of soft-hearted businessmen. They're anything but. When Jonathan Tiernan Lock happened, Dave Brailsford had a very tough week. He wasn't getting a tough week from Jonathan Tiernan Lock, even the Bradley Wiggins, Chris Froome situation. He was getting a tough week from Be Sky B bosses who were thinking, how can this happen? How can this be the kind of sting in the tail of the year? And that was tough for Dave. But in an overall sense, would Be Sky B ever walk away or News Corp walk? My guess, I think relatively educated, is that this has been a fantastic thing. Because what Sky have used this to say is, look, we need people to sit on couches and watch sport. But that's not exclusively what we're about. We want people getting on their bikes, getting out there. And you know, they've linked their sponsorship of the team to the wider campaign to get people on their bikes. And BT Sport are now a serious rival. Sky need to be able to say, we're not just like BT Sport just trying to put bums on couches. We're trying to put bums on saddles and get people out and be active. And I think the team has been a tremendous marketing tool for them. And I think they're not leaving anytime soon. Look, I mean, we know something is happening with Sky when they say, you know what, we're looking for a joint sponsor. We're looking for some other big name on the jersey. We're looking for a big name on the shorts. They're saying, no, we don't want any other name. We want this exclusively Sky. That, to me, is the attitude of people who are seriously committed.
Let's look out for the BT Sport team headed up by Bradley Wiggins, eh?
This is the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Free.
We'll move on to Lance Armstrong in a minute, but one question I want to ask you, sort of follow up to your last answer about James Murdoch and about the Sky, the sort of corporate involvement. As I mentioned at the start, you work for Sunday Times. It's something that a lot of people have mentioned. Can you explain the mechanics of how that works? I mean, were you aware of any interest even in what you were doing this year from up the sort of the higher corridors of the company?
No. If there was any interest from the higher echelons of the country, of the company, it never came down to me. My sports editor never said, by the way, you know, the Jeremy Darroch has you know, said he liked the piece or anything like that, the head of Sky Sports. I've heard nothing, and that's the way I'd prefer it. And the only time that I was aware of the connection where I felt it, and this is an admission that some people will find, certainly the people who would be supportive of Jonathan Tiernan Lock will find difficult, when I said to my boss, my sports editor Alex Butler, look, a Sky rider has been sent out a letter by UCI asking him to explain a discrepancy in his bio passport. I said, the guy's name is Jonathan Tiernan Lock. As far as I know, he got the letter earlier this week and he's got a case to answer. And Alex's line was, he said, because of our connection, you know, parent company is the same as the people who are sponsoring the team, this is a story we have to actually do big. You know, we have to say to our readers, we are independent, and we will be independent.
I think this is what a lot of people don't get, that journalists are not by nature perhaps company men, and that often you're overcompensating if anything.
Absolutely. And in this case, we did. I mean, we did 2 pages on that story. A writer been asked to explain a discrepancy, and not exactly a high-profile writer. not like a Bradley Wiggins or a Chris Froome or a Richie Porte or an Ian Stannard or a Beak or even any of the tour men. This is somebody who didn't really ride many of the big races. And two pages, was it overkill? I would say possibly. And I would say the explanation for that was he was a Sky rider. And in fairness to Owen Slot, you know, the Times were the paper that first, from what I remember, first went big on the Linder story. Mm-hmm. So you could say that that the two most kind of negative stories about Sky, one was broken in the Times and the other was broken in the Sunday Times.
Interesting. We'll move on to Lance, will we? Although I do want to just read one more line from your book, because it's my favourite line in your book. Did Coppi use PowerPoint? He did not. That strikes at the heart of the Sky, the Sky model, I think. So moving on to Lance, can you just reassure us first that you are David Walsh and not Chris O'Dowd?
Yes.
We haven't got a stand-in today, have
no,
we?
No. You'd know if the stand-in was here, because he'd be standing about 9 inches over me. because it is the physical similarity will be apparent to nobody.
Well, the cinema screen squashes everyone down a bit, so it'll be fine.
Weirdly, Jonathan Tiernan Locke once said recently that he described me as the journalist who looks like Chris O'Dowd. Weirdly, this was before Chris O'Dowd. I should explain, Chris O'Dowd has been cast as David Walsh in the film that's being made by Stephen Frears of the Lance Armstrong Story, based on your book.
Yes, based on Seven Deadly Sins.
How involved have you been?
Yes, well, I've been on set. I've been there. I was there for 2 days, and it was a really interesting experience to see, you know, somebody play you in a certain scene that you. Obviously, the scene that I remember is quite different, but they're portraying what happened in that scene pretty accurately.
Is it the scene in Liège where you're
walking? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's funny because Jeremy Whittle and I were driving past you at that moment, and we just saw you at the side of the road, and we were getting the other direction, actually. Yes. I hastened to add, so we couldn't have stopped.
Yes.
But Jeremy said, I wonder what David's doing walking. Yeah.
Jeremy subsequently said to me that his memory of what he said was, Jesus, it looks like Walsh has been fecked out of the car. And that was a joke. You know?
You should explain that is in fact really what happened.
Exactly.
Yeah,
yes, it was.
It's in your book.
Yes, it was. Yeah, yeah. John Wilkinson, whom I travelled with. I mean, this was 2004. Lance was going for his sixth. LA Confidential had just come out. The book that I thought was going to change the world had changed nothing. We'd had a press conference. Lance had handled the talk. Lance had handled the book brilliantly. There was basically one question that he answered about the book. And there was a follow-up by the same journalist, Mark Belenfante. And Armstrong just said, no comment, not dealing with it, next question. And that was it. And Lance actually ended up that press conference thanking those journalists who had reached out to him with text messages and emails saying he had nothing to worry about, blah, blah, blah. Now, I came out of that press conference, and John Wilkinson, whom I travelled with in first time ever in 1984, the year Lauren Finian won brilliantly, and as it turned out, Finian was brilliant that year. John and I had travelled for 20 years, and maybe I travelled about 12 times over that 20-year period. I've spoken to him a week before. I'm in the car. I'm coming up. There's going to be Andy Hood, Rupert Guinness, David Walsh, John Wilkinson. Come out of the press conference, and sitting down, John kind of sidles over to me and said, David, I just want to say that we've got a difficulty in relation to the car. You can't travel with us. And I remember I kind of played the poor man, and I said, John, I've got no one else to travel with. I shrugged his shoulders in the way that John sometimes does. And I was basically left on the side of the road. I remember Rupert looking the other way, being really embarrassed, but not knowing what to say. It was quite a sad situation, really.
You're listening to the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast, powered by Sharp.
David, what I suppose we want to know is, has Lance been in touch with you over the last year?
No.
There's been no contact at all?
No, the only kind of direct, kind of the only indirect contact was on the day that Brian Cookson announced his candidature for UCI presidency. I tweeted that cycling fans around the world should unite and back Brian Cookson. And Lance retweeted that, which was interesting that he should retweet something I'd written, because, forgive my ignorance on Twitter, but you have to follow somebody to know what they're tweeting, don't you?
Not necessarily.
He could have picked up somebody else retweeting
it
and retweeted it on. Yeah. But that was the only kind of direct connection.
What would you say if he you know, if that had been him on the phone there?
I would love to have a chat with him, if I'm being honest, but not really to do an interview as such. I would like to ask him certain things. I'd like to ask him, what did he feel he had that allowed him to say things about other people that were viciously offensive? And I would say, did he ever think that maybe that reflected kind of some sociopathic tendencies? And is it something that he's interested in dealing with? Because that was a big thing. I mean, lots of people doped. Nobody who doped turned on their accusers like Lance did. And it was that sense of entitlement that he felt he could do it. And it didn't make him a bad guy.
The interesting thing that strikes me about Lance is how calculated he is in everything he says and does. I mean, joking about whether he's contacted you or not, he did say, I think, in the Oprah interview, I think he actually said, I would apologise to David, which is obviously stopping short of apologising or, you know, not actually opening the door, but giving the hint, the suggestion that he might. And it's interesting you say, you suggest whether he has sociopathic tendencies, because just observing his kind of alpha maleness, his kind of dominance over people, it would appear, you know, sort of as a complete layman, it would appear that he does have that kind of characteristic and that kind of personality. But is that something you think that he does need to address in the coming years for his own sake?
Yeah, I mean, I think he does. And I mean, I know he's apologised to Emma O'Reilly now, but what he said about Emma was just so disgraceful, so horrible. And you know, and connected to that was, I'd say, Lance, from my understanding of how you, with Bernil, ran US Postal, I think you were the major player in running this team. You weren't just a team leader, road captain. You were the general, and Bernil was your first lieutenant. You organised like stuff like nutrition and equipment and training. I mean, obviously Ferrari was a big influence on training, but Lance was a big influence. I remember Frankie Andrea once telling me that Lance, I think it was Frankie Andrea, looked at the cereals they were eating and it was kind of a muesli and clusters. And Lance picking up a cluster and saying, you know what holds this effing thing together? Sugar. You know, as if sugar was kind of, you know, Satan in dietary form. And they changed the cereal the next day. That was it. And that's the kind of detail Lance was in. I'd say, Lance, that to me shows real strong analytical intelligence. But how come you were so dumb emotionally? How come you thought that in the year 2000, when you'd had enough of Emma O'Reilly, that you could allow Bernil to treat her like shit, allow her to leave the team in this very disgruntled state, and yet you presumed she was going to carry your secrets to the grave?
He was unbelievably sloppy in that sense, wasn't he? I mean, even at the time, I remember when Floyd Landis joined the team, as you learned more about Floyd Landis, you always felt that it was someone who could be, you know, I don't want to call him a loose cannon, but he was someone with a very strong personality.
Loose cannon.
Yeah. Yeah. And he was always a dangerous individual to have in that team, in the sense that, you know, if he felt slighted
his
in any
way. His circle of trust was surprisingly big, wasn't it? Really.
What are we talking about here? Just except a lack of emotional intelligence?
David, he doesn't seem to be showing too much remorse. You get the impression from when you see him, when you read interviews, that he's actually living fairly well, apart from obviously the stress of the court cases hanging over him. Do you get the sense that is true? That he, you know, he there hasn't been any huge amount of soul searching that's gone on in the past year or so?
I think he's intellectually capable of saying, I need to be remorseful here. Yeah. I think emotionally he can't do it. He just can't carry it off because it isn't there. And I think it's people who have sociopathic tendencies, one of the hallmarks of that condition is incapable of showing regret, of expressing sorrow.
Or feeling it.
Or feeling it, yes. Yeah, yeah, no, you're right. Yeah. That's the distinction. Yeah. You're absolutely
right. I spoke to somebody the other night who knows him vaguely and said that he's struggling with is not being able to compete. And I saw him on Twitter the other day challenging the current Ironman champion. I'm not au fait actually with who that is, but challenging the current Ironman champion to a sort of two-man race. And his his need to compete is still the driving force, and this is being so that probably dictates all his public utterances. Yeah.
Is it a need to compete, Richard, or is it a need to be relevant, to be some kind of figure who's out there that people realise this is happening? I think he loves competing for sure, but I've had an impression of all his contact with journalists now. It's almost like he's an interview wanting to happen. And why is he putting himself out there like that? Because he's struggling with being irrelevant. It's like, and why have all the interviews that more or less all the interviews he's done have been with the European media? He's done Cycling News, he did BBC, he did the Daily Mail. Why not the US media? My view of that is that the US media just ain't interested. And it's like the difference is European fans of the sport, or fans of sport, were outraged by Lance. But we didn't invest emotionally in the way the American audience did. And the American audience got behind their man, and they turned on France, and they turned on his accusers wherever they were. America invested emotionally. And when the truth came out, Americans then just felt betrayed. And when you feel betrayed, it's natural to almost say, you know what, never want to deal with that again. Never want to have anything to do with this guy. And I think Lance is really struggling with the fallout, because the fallout is irrelevant.
I think the desire to be relevant, also the search for meaning in life, and being an athlete, being in that state of fitness, having the daily routine of training, I think gave his life, as it does any athlete, gave it great meaning. Do you have any sympathy for him at all? I mean, do you?
I have sympathy for him on one basis, and one basis only. And this was really relevant to the Oprah Winfrey interview. I thought she did a brilliant job, I have to say. But what she didn't do in that interview was to say, you know what, Lance, you did all these bad things, and I know you used cancer as a shield, and I know you used cancer to raise money, but you did actually reach out to lots of kids who were afflicted by cancer, and you did actually do a hell of a lot of work in relation to bringing comfort to those afflicted by cancer. She never said that, and nobody has. Now, this guy did that. I'm sure that, not sure, my guess is that in his way, he saw this as a balancing of the scales. On this side, all the doping, all the bullying, all the bad stuff. On this side of the scales, I'm sending texts to little kids who are afflicted by leukemia. I'm sending texts to people who are really in need of comfort and support and encouragement and inspiration. And I'm doing a hell of a lot of it. And I don't see any other sportsman in the world doing this, but I'm doing it. So in a sense, we have a balance here. We have a scales that are like this. But when the fallout came, the good part was just knocked off the scales, and the bad stuff counted for everything. I mean, to think that Oprah did 3.5 hours of interview and she never gave him an out by talking. She never gave him that little reprieve or that little moment of refuge where, let's talk about the good stuff you've done, Lance. He must have been crushed by that. And I've heard him say in different interviews, you know, that he kind of couldn't believe that that he hasn't got credit for the good that he did.
Just on cycling in general, and the shadow that Lance Armstrong's era still casts over the sport. I mean, let's face it, the scepticism with which Bradley Wiggins and Chris Froome's victories were treated by some people, and the booing on outdoers, and the kind of the general sense that the tour cannot be won clean because of Lance Armstrong. Where do you see cycling going in the next 2 to 3 years? Because, you know, you've kind of broadly come out and said you believe in, well, you have come out and said you believe in Chris Froome and the fact that he's won the Tour de France clean, and yet there is still this kind of big cloud of scepticism hanging over the sport. At what point and what steps do you think the sport in general needs to make to kind of right its image to the broader population?
Yeah, I think it's just going to be chip, chip, chip away and knock little bits off the scepticism that people feel. I think it would actually be helpful for the sport if Chris Froome were to win it again and say to people, this guy actually is a bit of a freakish talent. He's got a talent for climbing mountains. He's pretty good against the clock, and he is clean. And I think if he were to be perceived as that, and the way cycling will do it is that they will keep their testing at the very least at the level it's at now, and they will continue to make it really difficult for somebody to cheat. I think they're really helped by the fact that the Tour de France is in France, I mean, I wrote in the book about, in Inside Team Sky, about Ollie Cookson, you know, who's the president's
Brian,
son,
Brian Cookson's,
Brian Cookson's son, being stopped with Rod Elling within the car and being very aggressively searched. Now, if that's happening to all the teams, there's no team bringing stuff into France and feeling comfortable about it. Because, you know, if Sky had anything in that car, they weren't getting away with it. And I think that's good. I think the biopassport must be continually done and upgraded and made better, and the testing out of competition must become more intense. And I saw it. I mean, I was in Kenya with Chris Froome, and he's up in the Masai Mara, a million miles from anywhere, and he's texting his coordinates off to the anti-doping people for the whereabouts system every single day, bar none. That must continue. We must, all of that must go on. And in the end, I think, if Froome were to stay at the top, what do people say if they don't come up with anything? If there isn't one scintilla of what I would call real evidence, well, how can the people go on saying, I don't believe?
David, you, in pursuing the Armstrong story, as you did, you felt all the time you were swimming against the tide, and certainly the popular opinion, cycling fans didn't want to disbelieve, and it's now like they don't want to believe. Do you see similarities in your position, that you at that time were pursuing a very unpopular story, and in a sense now you're also pursuing an unpopular story?
A little bit, yeah. I think we're now talking about a vociferous minority. I think there's actually quite a lot of people who believe in Chris Froome, I really do. But, and I think they're a majority, but I think we don't hear them nearly as much as we hear the people who are not believing. And, you know, my feeling about, I was thinking about this as we're talking, you know. One of the very first reasons I disbelieved Lance Armstrong was that Lance's Richie Port was Kevin Livingston. Kevin Livingston was involved in a doping investigation in Italy. He was a client of Michele's Ferraris. Ferrari was about to stand trial for doping. Now, can you imagine what all those people who are sceptical about Chris Froome would say if it emerged that secretly Richie Porte had been working with a doping doctor in Italy? Then they'd have me on their side. Then they'd have me saying, yeah, let's investigate this. This is good. This tells us something. This tells us that the first lieutenant isn't what he says he is. But there isn't that. There's no sense of that. There's been no indication of that. All we get are the numbers. And if there's one argument I've tuned out from, is the armchair exercise physiologist telling me what Chris Froome's time on the Vaughan 2 means.
I think we all got frustrated by that. I was watching a BBC 4 programme the other night about philosophy, as you do, or flick past it. And there was Sir Humphrey from Yes, Prime Minister, talking about the politician's fallacy. He said, cats have four legs, my dog has four legs, therefore it must be a cat. It's a bit like the Chris Froome... It's a bit like if Chris Froome... No, but this harks to the fact of Lance Armstrong, a doped-up Lance Armstrong, being used as a benchmark for what is humanly possible with doping. And I don't think that is... I don't think we can say that. And that basically is the problem. There's a problem, obviously, of how you time it accurately, etc., how you take into account all the variables, all the conditions, etc., etc., etc. But a straight comparison for me is meaningless. It's meaningless. And there's a lot of focus on this argument that clean performances will at one point surpass doping performances. Of course they will.
Well, they already have. Because, I mean, lots of the records, some of the records set by the East German women in field events have remained.
Mm.
I think the 400 metres is still there, Marita Cox. But plenty of those East German records, which we know were achieved by doping, have been surpassed since. I mean, Tim Kerrison, according to the logic of, you know, Chris Froome was faster than Armstrong, that means on a certain mountain, that means Chris Froome is a doper. Well, then we know Tim Kerrison must be a doping coach, because he coached Queensland swimmers to better the world records of Chinese swimmers that we know were doping. Now, nobody has ever suggested that Tim Kerrison was involved in a doping program in Queensland and Australian swimming. Nobody has ever suggested that. People have always believed the Australian swimmers came from a clean program. But they did beat records set by people who doped. So it seems to me that it's a logic that is applies that is applied pretty exclusively to cycling, especially to Team Sky. And it's not something we've actually mentioned here, but it's really come across to me. There's just there's a lot of people out there who don't like Team Sky for reasons not to do with doping.
Mm.
But doping is the stick that they use to beat Team Sky and basically exercise their bias against the team.
The Cycling Podcast with humansinvent.com. Innovation, craftsmanship and design.
Okay, competition time. We've got our mystery voice, which we've played clips of the last 2 weeks. Nobody has got it yet. Michael Rasmussen, Marcel Kittel, Tom Steels, Lorenzo Lepage, Cervas Canavan, Brian Holm, Yaroslav Popovich, Jens Voigt. It's none of these guys at all.
Can I give a clue?
Yeah, I think we should offer a clue because this is the third week.
I wrote an email which mentioned who the mystery voice was to someone in Cycling Today, and I described him as Bad Santa.
You write an email to somebody mentioning the mystery voice isn't really much of a clue, is it?
No.
But Bad Santa is a good clue, right? Bad Santa. So the prize for this is a copy of Sky's the Limit, a copy of the Cycling Anthology, Volume 3. I did offer all three volumes, but actually you've sold out of Volume 1.
Volume 1 has gone now, yeah.
So Volume 3 of the Cycling Anthology. David, could we trouble you for a copy of Inside Team Sky?
Yes,
to add to our little bouquet of prizes. So, a copy of Inside Team Sky as well. So, here is the mystery voice.
You should not become the fool of the media. Should not become the fool of a liar like him. And this is disappointing from you, from the media.
So that was the mystery voice. Please enter the competition. Tweet at humansinvent, hashtag mystery voice, at humansinvent, hashtag mystery voice, for a copy of Sky's the Limit Anthology Volume 3 and Inside Team Sky. Here it is again.
You should not become the fool of the media. Should not become the fool of a liar like him. And this is disappointing from you, from the media.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. For more articles, go to humansinvent.com/cycling.
Yeah, David, one question I had was, have you had any feedback, any reaction from anyone at Team Sky to the book?
No, not yet. I mean, my feeling is that they may not like it because there's certain things in there will make them feel uncomfortable. But they had no say in anything I wrote. They didn't ask for any say. They didn't ask to read it. I certainly wasn't going to show it to them if they did ask. So it's been very much my kind of interpretation of my year with them. I think in an overall sense the team comes out of it well, but I know enough about writing stuff about people to know that the subjects that you write about don't always see it in an overall way. They pick out the bit they don't like, which might be 2%. They forget the 98% and they feel aggrieved. And my feeling would be if they are aggrieved, well, it ain't going to be
the problem. Door may be closed to you in the future.
Yeah, it might well be.
I might be embedded with Tinkoff next.
That would have its compensations, I'm told.
That would be an interesting assignment.
It would. Yeah. I think more colourful and probably better social life.
Okay, so we should wrap up today's podcast. David, I think Lionel asked you a question latest, but you obviously were back on the cycling scene this year. What's going to be your involvement next year? You've got the World Cup next year as well,
yeah.
Obviously, but will you be back at the tour next year?
Yeah, I've discussed it with my boss because it was a big decision. I've done the last number of football World Cups, and normally I would do the football World Cup, but the newspaper basically thinks that I can be more valuable to them at the Tour de France, and that's where I'm going to be. I mean, if it was left to me, I'd be very reluctant to say no to the football World Cup, but I'd be even more reluctant to say no to the tour. I mean, I think it's going to be a really interesting tour next year because Nibali is going to be very strong. I think a much stronger rival than Chris Froome had this year. So I think it's going to be extremely difficult for Sky to win a third in a row.
Great. Well, thank you very much for joining us on the podcast this week. Hope you enjoyed it.
Yes, I did. Very much so.
Daniel, thank you.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.